Why are they deserving of such a lavish 10-CD box set?
Well, partly because they've been ignored for quite so many years. I mean, they've been a bit of a footnote. And they're generally, well, it's accepted now that they were the first band to call their music psychedelic.
Where did this word psychedelic come from? Because, I mean, now it's used to cover a multitude of sins, but at the time it referred to a kind of subculture. You know, this is the sort of 1966, wasn't it?
It's actually 65, when they formed in Austin, Texas in November 65. And there was already a sort of a peyote culture there that had grown up around this club called it was a place called the Ghetto, where the anthropology students at the university were synthesizing their own mescaline directly from cacti bought at Hudson's Cactus Ranch. So there was already this sort of psychedelic interest, but it was all very, very somber. There was no party atmosphere. And then in 65, LSD, which was obviously legal till about 1970 in the state of Texas, came from Lyndon Johnson's ex-speechwriter, Billy Lee Brammer. So you can't get much stranger than that, really.
And I mean, a lot of 60s groups of that period did indulge in hallucinogenic drugs. But for the 13th Floor Elevators, they didn't just take drugs for recreational purposes, did they?
Absolutely not, no. There was never a party atmosphere, even though people might find that difficult to understand because they did obviously perform gigs. But they were very much from the point of view of Arto's Theatre of Cruelty. And this whole lineage of art and theatre, where they really want to have an effect upon their audience. And most of this stemmed from the work of Tommy Hall, who was a kind of slightly Svengali lyric writer. And he was very interested in this idea of taking acid and the band playing the acid and actually causing sort of synesthesia in the audience. The audience would get high at the same time as the band. And they managed to sort of break the audience and band's sort of stage barrier and actually turn the audience on so they'd be more responsive to his ideas and his sort of manifesto.
Austin, Texas was quite a sort of liberal kind of hippie oasis in what's kind of quite a conservative part of the United States.
It is now. I mean, yeah, the joke was they actually managed to open a psychedelic ballroom there in 67 called the Vulcan Gas Company. And the joke was that you could travel, you know, 1,000 miles in any direction without meeting an enlightened soul anywhere. But back in, you know, 1960s, I mean, you know, you literally had to leave town. There was nothing going on. There was already the kind of trade route, the beatnik route to San Francisco, which obviously after the elevators got busted, which happened within a month of them forming, they pretty much headed up to San Francisco because it was the only way to sort of make a... Well, they tried it in Dallas. It didn't work for them. They were just constantly getting hounded. You know, they avoided prison by some miracle. And so they had to get out and get to San Francisco basically in order to survive.
And Tommy Hall also provided that kind of juddering sound you can hear in 13th Floor Elevators records. This was the electric jug. I mean, what was that and how did he play it?
Well, really, it was just a small whiskey clay jug that they used to, like a Victorian whiskey jug. And he was really keen on, well, it was jug bands were quite the tradition back in the day. And the idea was you played a kind of slow percussive tone into the jug so the resonance and bounce would come out, but he wasn't really interested in that, so he wanted to play well, he first started trying to play the mandolin, but he couldn't master a string instrument, and he was into jazz and, you know, monophonic drone and all these ideas, but he just couldn't master an instrument. So instead he held a microphone over the jug and sort of mimed and almost faked playing the jug, making this weird sort of noise, and it used to annoy the hell out of their lead guitarist, Stacey Sutherland. But it became their trademark sound. And for him, it was putting the acid into the music. And I should probably mention that every gig, pretty much without fail, was played with the entire band, apart from the drummer, tripping on acid. So they were really kind of insanely committed to this quasi-religious mission they had, which obviously sort of sealed their fate in the long run.
The nearest they had to a hit was You're Gonna Miss Me.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, that was actually written by Rocky Erickson prior to the band setting up, but...
Rocky Erickson's the singer.
The lead singer, yeah. I should probably mention him because he obviously is quite famous. He's the person most people have heard of because he had a career, still going today. He's still sort of playing all over the world. But he had written this song called You're Gonna Miss Me when he was about 14, and already released it as a single when the Elevators formed, but it was popular regionally and it sort of made 55 on the Billboard charts nationally. So the band got accused of stealing the singer and the song, obviously, and they re-recorded that within a few weeks. And again, you know, Tommy put the acid in by adding the jug, and then later on had to kind of sort of vicariously add all this, his doctrine. He was very much into Gorbisky and General Semantics. So he would add all these layers that someone joked would sound, you know, all of the philosophers he liked sounded like the bottom of an eye chart.
and he'd give them a lecture, the audience a lecture before the band's performance.
This happened, yeah, early on he tried doing that when they were playing at UT.
Doesn't sound like much fun.
No. I mean, you've got to think, you know, from the ghetto days, this was all very, very somber. These people took themselves very, very seriously. You know, they did play in teen clubs and stuff like that. But that, for Tommy, was all just proselytizing the word. I mean, he's very much like a kind of southern preacher almost. And later on in 68, he got to the point where he just was working on his ideas. He didn't really care about the band much, but he'd turn up and he'd want an hour to lecture before gigs. And obviously he's mixing, you know, Christian religion with LSD. And the cops didn't like that at all. They'd kind of literally, you know, reach for their guns and go, "You better collect that boy."
I mean, this kind of confrontation with all the authorities isn't something we see at all these days. I mean, it's quite extraordinary to imagine, really.
Yeah, there's no way. I mean, they are the original rock and roll suicide tale. There's no way that any band that, you know, it makes the Sex Pistols, the Beatles story just seem like really, really boring. You know, by the end of the decade, Tommy was living in a cave on Laguna Beach. Rocky pleaded insanity and ended up 3 years in a mental home for the criminally insane. Stacey ended up in the prison that Rocky pleaded insanity to avoid. Ronnie, the bass player, was drafted Vietnam, and the drummer had electroshock treatment. I mean, I can't think of any band, you know, that can compare with that.
Now, I mean, you've put together, Paul, this extraordinary 10-CD box set with reproduction memorabilia and a detailed book to go with it as well. I mean, this has been a real labour of love for you. Tell us how you put it together.
Well, it's been 10 years' work. I mean, I never envisaged it going on this long. I mean, first off, I wrote a book called I Mind that was the kind of... it was more of the objective... history of the band. I relied very heavily on the oral history from all the band former band members who I obviously tracked down. That was just a paperback book. So the important thing was then to try and rescue what's left of the, you know, recordings, and particularly all the live material. So I sort of set about. It's literally like a museum to the band. It's 10 CDs and the sort of 10 chapters, one relating to obviously each CD. And it's every photo, every known piece of memorabilia. So it's like it's the proper museum to the bands. But the other one's very long-winded. This one's much more clear, subjective look at the music and what was left behind.
And you needed the cooperation of the surviving members of the band in order to really put this together.
I felt so. I thought, you know, there'd been lots of attempts before to reissue and remaster this music. And... you know, people just didn't understand it. They'd try and take the reverb off and alter the way the music sounded. So it's very important to me, not being a music producer, to get their original producer, Walt Andrus, back on board in the project. You know, Rocky popped in and thought it was all very entertaining, and we were listening to these old tapes. And then we involved, and, you know, I mean, I would like to, if more of the members had been there, actually remastered music, but, I mean, you know, too many cooks. But they were all supportive, and they were all, you know, very pleased with the outcome, I think. So,
where can we hear the influence of the 13th Floor Elevators today?
Well, there's too many bands to list. I mean, it starts off with, you know, Rocky teaching Janis Joplin to project her voice instead of just screaming. Robert Plant's a known fan. And then it just literally every decade you can sort of name drop Patti Smith. You know, she had an album called Easter Everywhere. Television were doing their stuff back on the Bowery in the mid-70s. The Cramps kept the music alive. Primal Scream, Basement 3, Spiritualized, Julian Cope. I mean, it goes on and on and on, really.